Hanukkah commemorates the rededication of the Old Temple in Jerusalem.
It also honors the lighting of the menorah and its symbolic representation of the spiritual strength of the Jewish people.
Our holiday special celebrates the stories of the season.
I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Murray Horwitz. Coming up on Hanukkah Lights,
Week at a Glance by Elisa Albert is a delightful 8-day journey that includes family, good friends, and an all-girl rock band.
In Eleanor Leans' story, Heir of Christmas, a young girl's allegiances are torn when the second night of Hanukkah falls on Christmas Eve.
Finally, we'll hear The Infidelity of Judah Maccabee by R.L. Mazes and the tumult of jealousy over a cat named Mac.
Our first piece is by Leah Pripstein. She was born in the Soviet Union and raised in Israel. Her short fiction has appeared in literary publications in Russian and English. She's currently at work on a novel. This is Of Love and Latkes.
Ava met Yaakov on bingo night at Beth Israel Senior Center. She helped him find the words on the board, and they got to talking. Yaakov had lost his wife, Clara, a few months before. Ava had been a widow for 5 years. They discovered they were both from the same region in the Ukraine and had lived in Brooklyn for about the same length of time.
Yaakov had food stains on his shirt and old tissues stuffed in his pocket, but what really got to Ava was a pitiful margarine sandwich Yaakov extracted from the inside of his jacket. She asked if he'd like to come over for dinner, and he said yes.
It was good to have someone to cook for again. With Sam, her late husband, they had such wonderful meals. Cooking had always been a passion, but cooking for Sam was especially satisfying, as no one was more appreciative of her creations than he. He smacked his lips and licked his fingers, declaring her the best cook in all of Brooklyn, or possibly even the whole of New York. Now, stirring plump fricadellen in golden broth, Ava imagined Yaakov's exultations, and her heart expanded.
Yaakov arrived with a bouquet of flowers. He was full of compliments for her apartment, how clean it was, how tastefully arranged. He examined the photographs of her grown grandchildren, pronouncing them handsome and bright. He was helpful, too, setting the table while she ladled the soup into bowls.
She watched him take a spoonful, then another, gulping the soup down with eagerness that suggested it pleased him. But he was oddly silent. No exclamations of delight or words of appreciation. How is it? She asked.
He nodded. Thank you very much.
She served the main course, chicken breast with a side of rice and a nice green salad, all to the same effect. Yaakov consumed his portion with relish, but said little more than thank you in response.
After dinner, he told her about his childhood as a son of party activists, how at a very young age he had learned to take care of the house, cleaning and cooking, mostly noodles, in time for his parents' return.
You poor thing, Ava said, recording the homemade delicacies her mother had put out for her.
Yaakov smiled at that. Sometimes I thought so too. Other times I didn't mind so much.
They made tea, and Ava served dessert. I hope you like jam rolls, she said, my mother's recipe.
Thank you, was all he gave her. Thank you for inviting me, he said, when it was time to go.
Would you like to come again Tuesday, she asked. I'll make borscht.
So it went for several weeks. Chicken soup, meat patties, pierogi with mushrooms and leeks, olfactory memories of life past permeating her apartment.
It's been so long since I've done real cooking, she said to Yaakov over a plate of pelmeni. It's not fun to cook just for yourself.
You can cook for me any time, he declared. She waited for him to say more, praise the quality of the food and her skill as a cook. He didn't, but nodded enthusiastically when she asked if he'd like some more.
She wondered why he was so tight-lipped when it came to her cooking. He seemed quite capable of complimenting her on everything else. For someone who'd grown up on noodles, he turned out to be exceptionally hard to please.
Thanksgiving they spent at their children's. Seizing a quiet moment alone with her daughter, Ava confided her fears.
What if I'm not as good a cook as I thought I was? Who knows what he was used to with Clara?
It's not the Middle Ages, Mama. There's more to relationships than food.
Ava frowned. Of course, food wasn't everything, but it wasn't nothing either. These days, women thought they could get away with takeout and frozen. What they failed to understand was that a home-cooked meal was more than nourishment. It was family and belonging, a taste of childhood, a kind of love. She didn't say any of that to her daughter. Instead, she said, "I want my efforts to be appreciated. Is that so bad?"
"Why don't you just ask him outright what he thinks of your cooking," her daughter said. Or if you must, ask him if you cook as well as his wife."
"Are you mad?" Ava gasped. "I could never. I'll just have to try harder, that's all." She came home determined. If everyday meals didn't do the trick, surely her specials would. Upon his return, Yakov was treated to her famed brisket and tzimis. Back in the day, this very dish had marked a turnaround in her relationship with her mother-in-law.
"You must love my son very much," the matron had said to Ava with tears in her eyes.
If she could melt her mother-in-law's heart, at the very least she should be able to elicit a word of acknowledgement from Yakov.
"Are you expecting company?" Yakov said when she uncovered the brisket.
"No, just you."
"Well, this is... Thank you, Ava." He devoured his portion and nodded when she offered more.
"Good?"
"Mmm." He shoved another forkful into his mouth. "Thank you."
"Why won't he just say the word? They didn't feed you at your son's house?" she asked.
He seemed not to notice her sarcasm. "My daughter-in-law doesn't cook," he explained, and then added with a chuckle, "They say I've gained weight since they last saw me."
So now her food was too fattening? "Did Clara cook low-fat?" she inquired, more than a little peeved.
His expression changed. "No," he said, so miserable she regretted saying anything.
"Eat, eat," she added tzimis to his plate. "If it's any consolation, I think you look good."
He smiled. "Not as good as you."
She wondered if her daughter was right. She enjoyed his company, and he enjoyed hers. Wasn't that enough? But when she tried to let go of it, it wouldn't let go of her. His refusal to utter anything more than and thank you felt unnatural, as if he was stopping himself from saying something he would regret.
For days, she agonized over her options. At last, she had an idea.
"Why don't I cook for you at your place this Friday night?" she said to him. The things Ava could not ask would be revealed once she stepped into Clara's kitchen. A woman's culinary interest, her skill, manifested itself in her workspace. And who better than Ava to pick up on those subtle indicators?
Yakov seemed reluctant at first. Ava would find it uncomfortable. The kitchen hasn't been used in a while. Ava dismissed his excuses. A change in scenery would do them both good, she said, and handed him a list of ingredients.
She brought her set of knives and condiments, and it immediately became apparent she shouldn't have bothered. The kitchen was small, but surprisingly well-equipped. Blenders, pressers, crushers, an assortment of spices she didn't know the names for, and a long shelf of cookbooks from Bulgarian to Southern French. The ingredients she had asked Yakov to buy awaited her on the counter. How plain her planned dinner seemed compared to the grand meals tucked in those pages. It took all of Ava's strength to put her apron on and start chopping, each turn of the knife making her wince.
It didn't help that Yakov kept pressing Clara's fancy tools on her. "See this? It slices the egg just so. And this is for pitting olives."
"I'll do it my way, thank you very much." She wished she could shoo him out of the kitchen, but this was his home, his and Clara's. At no time since she'd met Yakov did she feel so out of place.
They lit the Shabbat candles and sat down to eat, with a photograph of Clara overseeing their dinner. Clara's pleasant face wore a sad little smile, as if, despite her best efforts, things hadn't turned out quite as she'd hoped.
Ava knew exactly how that felt. She hardly touched the veal and cauliflower. Long ago, this very dish had her daughter's boyfriend returning until he'd finally proposed. Now it tasted of caustic embarrassment.
"You're not hungry?" Yakov asked with a mouthful of food.
"No."
"You've tired yourself out with all that cooking," he said. "Why don't you rest on the couch?"
She complied, letting him take off her shoes and place her feet in his lap.
"I used to do that for Clara when she got anxious," he said, massaging her heel.
His hands felt good, but Ava could not enjoy them. "I was wrong to come," she said. "This dinner, it must remind you of Clara."
"Remind me? No. With Clara, it was different." He glanced sadly at his unfinished plate. "Completely different."
That was it, then, the terrible truth. No matter how she tried, she would always come short. His eagerness that she'd mistaken for satisfaction was nothing more than a rush to be done with her food. And she, the fool that she was, kept offering him second helpings. She got up from the couch. "I should go," she said, grabbing her coat and purse.
He seemed surprised, but didn't try to stop her. I'll walk you home," he offered.
"Please don't. I'll be fine." December wind chilled her all the way home, but she hardly noticed. Her body was frozen in shame for her arrogance and stupidity. She had assumed she was giving him something of value, when in truth it was an ordeal for him. He might have thought he was sparing her feelings by keeping silent, but he just made it worse.
He called the next morning. She didn't pick up. The day after, he left 3 messages. The last one sounded quite desperate. "Call me, please."
She called him.
"Thank God," he said. "I was about to send in a search party."
"No need. I'm fine."
There was an awkward silence. Then he said, "Tomorrow is the first night of Hanukkah. I thought we could light candles, eat some latkes. Not that I want you to cook. God knows you've cooked enough. They sell frozen latkes at the..."
"I can make latkes, Yakov," she cut him off.
"Of course you can," he agreed. "Should we say 5 o'clock?
5 is fine," she hung up, fuming. Latkes he wanted to spare her. Latkes that she could whip up with her eyes closed and both hands tied behind her back. Oh, the wonderful latkes she used to make for Sam. Potato and leek, sweet potato and raisin, zucchini patties, and bite-sized fried salmon balls. Her husband never had to eat the same latke twice.
But no sooner had she recalled her past achievements than her gloom returned. No matter what she did, the memory of Clara's cooking would always hover over Yaakov and her like a bitter aftertaste. If only she could care less, put a little less soul into her cooking. But that was like asking her to love with less heart.
She went to bed on an empty stomach. In her dreams, Clara was serving her latkes, golden and fluffy like Ava's mother used to make. She awoke sore and morose. By midday, when the time came to start frying, she was perfectly despondent. She had cut herself twice on the grater, something she hadn't done since she'd learned how to grate. She had poured too much oil, and it hissed and spit, covering her bare arms with tiny burns. She recalled how long ago, when her teenage daughter rejected her cooking, her husband had tried to console her.
"Sometimes love is knowing what's needed, not giving all you can give," he had said. She was mad at him for saying that, as if she didn't know her own child. But he was right. She wanted to make her daughter happy her way, just as she did with Yaakov.
When Yaakov showed up, he found the apartment smoky and Ava in tears.
"What happened? Did you hurt yourself?"
She pointed at a pile of black-bottomed latkes. "I was a fool, trying to impress you with my cooking, when in truth I'm quite mediocre, certainly not as good as your Clara."
He stared at her, speechless, then burst out laughing, so hard she feared he might break a rib. "Oh, God, Ava, I miss Clara. I do, but her cooking?" He picked up a scorched latke. "This is the closest you ever got to Clara's cooking. Clara was a wonderful, sensitive person, but a terrible, terrible cook."
"But all those cookbooks, the tools."
"She kept trying, hoping it would make a difference. It didn't. It was her biggest disappointment."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"I didn't know I needed to. Clara was so insecure about her cooking, even compliments made her cry. I learned to say thank you and nothing more." He took Ava's hand and kissed the inside of her palm. "I loved every single thing you made for me."
Ava cupped his face in her hands and kissed him for the longest time. Tomorrow she would make spicy squash latkes to go with the second candle. She had so much more to give.
That was Of Love and Latkes by Leah Pripstein. Our next story is by Elisa Albert. Her most recent novel is After Birth, and her fiction and nonfiction have appeared in the New York Times, Time Magazine, Tin House, and The Guardian. This next piece was originally published in an anthology called How to Spell Hanukkah, put out by Algonquin in 2007. Here it is now, Week at a Glance.
1. It's simultaneously the first night of Hanukkah, my grandpa's 98th birthday, Christmas, and the last week of 2005. I am home for a visit, my first in months. My mother is hosting a party. We light one candle tonight for the first night, and this other candle is called the Shamas, she explains. Present are my father and stepmother, my brother and his girlfriend, some cousins, my mother, papa, and me. Things are a wee bit tense for many boring and complicated family reasons, all of which boil down to, I can't wait to get out of here. I sing thinly along with the baracha. By the soup course, the man of the hour, Grandpa, not Jesus, is nodding off at the table, a paper party hat resting asymmetrically on his head. One cousin is totally wasted and keeps telling me that I have sadness inside me and that she would like to offer me complimentary hypnotism. An adorable teenage cousin smiles shyly and repeats,
What up, Carrie Bradshaw?
Ostensibly because I live in New York and spend a good deal of my time having cocktails with the girls, sleeping with strangers, and lounging around my apartment staring at my laptop. I feel empty and morose, and strangely enough, not even my gift-wrapped copy of this year's Best American Short Stories, thanks, Mom, makes things better. I wonder whether I should wake up Papa so that he can enjoy his party. But he's probably happier asleep, and I'm more than a little jealous. If I could nap through family time, I'd probably enjoy being around my family a great deal. I excuse myself before birthday cake is served and lay on a dew-covered chaise in the dark backyard. I have voicemail, the blinking red light on my flip phone like a beacon of hope. It's from my drunk boyfriend, himself home for a visit in the Midwest, wishing me a Shabbat Shalom, which is funny since, of course, it's not Shabbat and he's not Jewish.
I'm calling all the Jews in my phone, but you're the only Jew in my phone, so really I'm only calling you.
This is sufficiently uplifting, and I spend the remainder of the evening trying to relax on the chaise, fruitlessly searching for even one solitary star in the Los Angeles night sky. A happy Hanukkah to one and all. 2. After last night's circus of despair, I forego the candle's ritual tonight. I have no plans, and I'm in too crappy a mood for polite company, and it's the day after Christmas, so the city feels shut down, desolate, totally depressing. There is only one thing to be done. Every Jew and his mother are seeing Munich tonight. What this means, I realize belatedly, is that I am trapped in the sold-out movie theater alongside roughly half of Hebe, L.A. How did I not foresee this? Inevitably, I run into several dozen friends of my parents and my ex-father-in-law, who proffers a small wave and therefore avoids eye contact.
Are you here by yourself?
As the fourth or fifth family acquaintance I run into, I feel completely pitiful. Christmas is a time for Jews to see movies together. No, I lie. Then I duck back into the crowd, muttering something about finding my friends. I locate a single seat next to an older couple who, thankfully, don't look the least bit familiar. They endear themselves to me 20 minutes into the film by nonchalantly passing me the popcorn. I have found my friends after all. When the lights come up at the end, the husband is white-knuckled with rage. What did you think? I ask him. As Maestro Spielberg himself has pointed out, this movie is something of a Rorschach test for Semitic passions. The man does not disappoint.
I'll tell you something. It ain't a picnic being a Jew after Auschwitz.
I want to point out that probably it wasn't a picnic to be a Jew during Auschwitz either, but I just nod as he goes on about counterterrorism not being morally equivalent to terrorism. I violently disagree, but I cannot afford to alienate my new friends, not when there's a veritable minefield of family acquaintances still filing out of the theater. He and his wife promised to buy my forthcoming book. I wish them a happy Hanukkah, and voila, the left and the right have called a special holiday truce. 3. My mother's Havurah has its annual Hanukkah party. The Havurah is a group of friends who meet once a month to schmooze, eat, and talk about books and politics. Even though I live 3,000 miles away and don't have all that much to say to anyone, I have known these people and their children for about as long as I can remember, and I'm increasingly grateful for this kind of continuity, which, hey, isn't so easy to come by. It's a warm, lively, colorful gathering, with food-laden tables and children underfoot and a pile of gifts by the fireplace. When we arrive, three candles and several hanukkiot are already burning in the window, casting a glow on the proceedings. The traditional gift exchange, also known as a Yankee swap, goes something like this. Everyone brings a gift costing about $15. We draw numbers out of a hat. Number one picks a gift and opens it. Number two can either swipe number one's gift or choose another gift to open, and so on down the line. It's best to get a high number so that you can see everything that's already been opened and take your pick. Fortunes can be won or lost in an instant. I'm excited to draw a whopping 17. There's a scented candle assortment, a baking kit with novelty cookie cutters, an M.C. Escher book, a T-shirt reading Kishmir and Tuchus, and then someone opens the gift I will claim for my own, a coffee table book entitled 50 Relatives Worse Than Yours. Later, on the way to the bathroom, I duck into a carpeted hallway lined with photos, wedding photos, portraits of the grandparents as young men and women, baby photos, the whole nine. Like all family photos, others and my own, they fill me with unwieldy bitterness and hardcore longing all at once. My old friend Heather picks me up. We go for Mexican food, listen to ancient CDs, and sing along more or less exactly like when we were 14. 4. Today I fly to Seattle to be with my friends Abby and Rachel. Abby and I both live in New York, but Rachel's in medical school up there, so we three haven't gotten to spend quality time together for a while. After some requisite gaping at the Space Needle, the lush hilly views, and the stunning multitude of lovely coffee shops and cafes around town, Rachel takes us to a Hanukkah party hosted by friends of hers, an engaged couple. The guy is Jewish, but the kind of Jewish that seems to back away from itself, not Jewish, mind you, but just Jew-ish. A real fan of Seinfeld kind of Jew, not that there's anything wrong with that. His fiancée is not a Jew, but has spent the last 3 days making latkes. "Are you guys Jewish?" she asks us politely. "Hell no," we say in jest. Then, when it's clear that irony has no place here, we change gears. "Yes, we're Jewish," Abby says, "and the latkes look great." "Do they?" our host asks anxiously. "Latkes are hard for everyone," I reassure her. When it comes time to light the menorah, our hosts cast about helplessly.
"Don't look at me,"
the guy says, backing away from the menorah like a vampire from a cross. Abby and I, Jewish day school alumnae both, have a brief argument over whether tonight's four candles go on the right or the left. I think they go on the right. She thinks the left. Rabbi Hillel said the right, and Rabbi Shammai said the left, so it's fine either way, Abby says, with more than a trace of sarcasm.
"Wow," someone says, "you guys really are Jewish."
We sing the Baracha alone, embarrassedly, like we're on display at the mall next to a giant tree, a cardboard menorah, and a fat old biker dressed up as Santa. 5. By some Maccabee miracle, Abby and I have scored a pair of below-market tickets on Craigslist to see a sold-out feminist punk band at the Showbox. What a day we're having. Strolling, shopping, eating, laughing. I love this city. It's official. And I love my friends. And now we're seeing our favorite band at a storied Seattle concert venue for $18, which is also high. But for the fact that my head still hurts a little after having expelled lemonade from my nostrils at dinner when Abby made me laugh too hard, I am having a grand time. We are busy dancing and sipping vodka tonics when the lead singer, between spectacular sets, makes mention of the big H. "So, tonight's Hanukkah," she says to the crowd, fiddling with the knobs on her guitar. There are a few cheers. It's a wonderful thing to belong so completely to my surroundings. This is what life is for, I think, to be a living, breathing, contradictory mess and belong entirely.
I think it's like the fifth night, the drummer says.
Woohoo! Yells a guy nearby.
We forget to light candles tonight, as it's 2 a.m. by the time the show's over, and it's raining, and we're pretty buzzed. So, as soon as we manage to find a cab back to Rachel's, we hightail it woozily to bed. 6. We get into a fight today. Rachel feels left out because Abby and I share a life in New York. I feel left out because Rachel and Abby wake up hours earlier than I do and go running. Why would anyone do such a thing? Abby's annoyed because Rachel's annoyed. Rachel's annoyed because I'm annoyed. Abby's annoyed because we only grudgingly indulge her vegetarianism, and so on. Is not so much a fight as a crossing of wires, a tripping over overlapping insecurities and anxieties. Finally, things boil over, and we have a good cry, profess our collective undying love and affection, and immediately feel better. I met Rachel at Jewish sleepaway camp when we were 11. We shared a bunk bed and got into a fist fight. A couple summers later, we, along with the other newly adolescent girls, were formally lectured by a kindly and quite well-respected rabbi about the importance of marrying as early as possible and starting a family, and about how prioritizing career and/or self-actualization would mean not only that we would die barren and alone, but that the Jewish people also would cease to exist. We rolled our eyes so hard they almost came loose. Tonight, Rachel's hosting Sabbath dinner, so we go to the market and prepare. My contribution will be my specialty, vegan cupcakes, which are not remotely as unappetizing as they may sound. There is a banana involved. The Sabbath crowd is made up of Rachel's housemates and several friends, most of whom are weekly regulars. It's that most rare of religious phenomena, organic. In the kitchen, the dudes are ritually washing their hands while they make up an intricate rap. Two play human beatbox while the third interweaves the barucha and something about his Shabbos witches, about, yes, ritual hand washing. Abby watches them agape. They're always doing that, Rachel sighs. We light the menorah, and tonight everyone in the room knows the words. Then we light the Sabbath candles, everyone joining in. Then we feast. 7. Another party tonight. It's New Year's Eve, though we find it hard to get all that amped up about a milestone so traditionally overloaded with good time pressure. Every year it's the same. The anticlimax so much more prevalent than the purported climax. Rachel's friends from medical school arrive in packs. A future anesthesiologist has brought the board game Cranium, which we are to play as the evening's entertainment. A future neurosurgeon bears a bottle of champagne in each fist. A future gynecologist brings her gangly 15-year-old brother because he had no other plans and she couldn't bear to leave him alone for the last first few hours of 2005-06. Two old friends of Abby's join the party, too, thankfully rounding out the liberal arts contingent. We four form a Cranium team, and the med students stick together. Here's a piece of advice. Don't ever play Cranium with a bunch of medical students. Especially don't ever play Cranium with a bunch of medical students if you are A, someone with an iota of perspective on board games, B, someone with an iota perspective on competition in general, C, intoxicated, or D, all of the above. We are incapable of taking the game seriously, which frustrates our furrowed-browed, adorably type A opponents no end. While they huddle together and strategize, we gleefully sing rounds of Light One Candle for the Maccabee Soldiers. We lose track of whose turn it is. We shout out answers to other teams' questions, trying to be helpful and sportsmanlike. And eventually, we legitimately win the game. This is infuriating to the med students, whose losing is almost enough to incite the kind of existential crisis usually sparked by fatal botched diagnoses in residency.
Good game. Congratulations, they say tightly.
By now, it's about 11:55, so we head out to the street with noisemakers and pots and pans, looking out over the city and the Space Needle where fireworks explode. We forgot all about the menorah. 8. We almost forget all about the 8th and final night, too. When we do finally remember, just before bed, we load up the whole menorah together. No debate tonight about where the candles go. We set it in the window, the rest of the house dark and quiet. It is the first day of 2006, and tomorrow we'll all go back to our lives. Rachel to 3 months of internal medicine rotation in Idaho. Abby and I to Chelsea in Brooklyn, respectively. It's going to be a big year for each of us. Lots of changes and miracles and achievements and stepping stones and new challenges we vaguely know are on their way. Who knows when we'll all be together again? I'm excited to hold the shamas, like when I was little, and it felt like a great honor. I light the candles from left to right, starting with the newest, and lighting one for each of the past 7 nights as I go. 8, with my friends and the sound of Seattle rain gently pelting the window under our 3 tone-deaf, exhausted voices. 7, the ruckus we made banging our pots and pans to usher in a new year while fireworks exploded over the city. 6, riotous Shabbos with friends. 5, in full bloom at the feminist punk show. 4, as token Jews. 3, with the Havara. 2, alone at the movies. And by the time I make it to the last candle, the first night, Christmas, Papa's birthday, my fraught family, I'm almost able to own even that. It's been a good week. It's a new year now, after all, and the whole menorah is glowing, full, finally complete. Abby and Rachel and I stand looking at the blazing menorah and its reflection in the window. Above it, our reflected faces linger. Then we turn away, off into a new phase, a new year. Our blessed, strange, different lives.
We Get a Glance by Elisa Albert. You can hear this program again and explore more holiday programs on our website, npr.org. I'm Murray Horwitz.
And I'm Susan Stamberg. You're listening to Hanukkah Lights from NPR. Ellen Orleans is the author of 5 books of gay and lesbian humor, including The Butches of Madison County, as well as the forthcoming memoir, Inside, The World is Orange. She's currently writing How to Spell the Name of God, which includes this story, Erith Christmas.
The yellow candle was strong-willed, if that's possible for a candle. My mother had warned me not to personify objects. Not my sneakers, not my stuffed animals, not Hanukkah candles, as it only made life more complicated. However, she wasn't there. I was sitting by myself at our kitchen table, only me and my family's tarnished brass menorah. 20 minutes earlier, as part of my brother's Guess Which Candle Will Burn the Longest game, I had chosen the yellow candle. Watching it now, it was hard not to assign it human qualities, plucky, enduring, a Maccabee. Only problem was, I'd misunderstood. My brother Doug's instructions had been to bet on which candle would burn out first, not last. With the red shamus gone in a quick puff of smoke 10 minutes ago, the game was long over. Still, I was determined to see which, the yellow first night candle or the blue second night, would outlast the other. Everyone else had abandoned the kitchen, my father to a temple board meeting, my mother to wrap presents for tomorrow, and my brothers and sister to watch How the Grinch Stole Christmas. If Judah Maccabee were here, he would not have been happy about that. So I sat alone, watching blue and yellow head toward their side-by-side extinctions. It is the nature of fire to exhaust its own fuel. Even forest fires eventually reach a lake or dirt road or the bare land of a prairie dog town. They must, I imagine, feel some relief to finally simmer down into smolder and glow. But those are the thoughts of someone much older, and that year, I was only 11. That year, the second night of Hanukkah fell on Christmas Eve. Erev Christmas, my father called it. Jewish holidays begin at sundown, and the Hebrew word Erev means evening, so Erev designates a Jewish holiday's first night. As a child, I found this joke, swapping Erev for Eve, overlaying the Hebrew onto the Christian, the outsider onto the dominant, extremely witty. I preferred years like this one, when Hanukkah overlapped Christmas and we Jews were part of the holiday hubbub instead of an early December anomaly. Tomorrow, Christmas Day, my aunts and uncle would visit. They were from my mother's side of the family, non-Jew Jews, or, as my mother more politely put it, cultural Jews. Even that distinction was generous. After all, Uncle George showered us with chocolate bunnies at Easter, while Aunt Charlotte and Nora decorated a handsome blue spruce in their Branch Brook home each December. I could hear Judah Maccabee telling me that giving chocolate bunnies and decorating Christmas trees was pretty much the same as offering a fattened pig to a Greek idol. Or was I personifying Judah Maccabee, who was mostly a myth anyway? That's what Aunt Jo believed. My father, no. Judah was as real as the Israeli soldiers at the Western Wall.
It's fine,
Aunt Jo reassured me when I told her I was worried that she and my uncle weren't real Jews.
It's good to be curious about other people's customs, to partake now and then.
She'd put her arm around me and whispered in my ear,
be a citizen of the world.
Judah would not have agreed with Aunt Jo. In fact, he might have cut her head off. Back at the kitchen table, a wedge of fire clung to each wick, the wax now a colorless puddle in the menorah's cupped branches. As I waited, I gathered the tin foil, candy boxes, and wrapping paper that littered the table. Right about now, I imagined, the Grinch was busy stealing presents, just as Cindy Lou Who went to fetch a glass of water. In addition to Erev Christmas, tonight had been Kids' Night, the night when, instead of receiving presents from our parents, we four children bought gifts for each other. My brother Benny, 7 years old and already savvy about people in a way I'd never be, had given each of us our favorite candy, Almond Joy for Doug and Double Mint Gum for Felicia, who was on a mint and gum spree.
I need to keep my breath fresh for Charlie,
she liked to say, reminding us once again she had a new boyfriend. I'd received a box of cavity-pulling jujubes, my favorite. Jujubes, Benny had said. Get it? He'd recently learned about puns and was thrilled with this one. Doug had distributed bright Eisenhower silver dollars, and Felicia had given out books, math puzzles for Doug and the Phantom Tollbooth for Benny. For me, a brand new copy of Charlotte's Web. I'd read my old one so many times, the pages were falling out. I had no theme for my gift-giving, but I contributed a Kelly Green wind-up clock to Felicia's collection, ticking away discordantly on a glass shelf in her bedroom, gave Doug travel chests to join the wood and quartz sets on his shelves, and added a shiny white ambulance to Benny's growing fleet of matchbox cars. This year he was hoping for a full set of emergency vehicles, ambulance, police car, fire truck. Even then, Ben was determined to save the world. I knew Hanukkah wasn't about the gifts, just as the Whos of Whoville knew Christmas wasn't about presents. Hanukkah was about beating back the Greeks, reclaiming the Holy Temple, and finding a vial of pure oil which miraculously lasted 8 days. And yet, there was something about the choosing and wrapping and giving of gifts that felt significant, tender, and kind. Wasn't that also valuable? I smelled the smoke before I saw the flame, or, more to the point, the flame's absence. The blue candle had burnt out. My yellow candle had triumphed over the others. I'd won, or depending upon how you looked at it, I'd come in last. To be fair, let's say I landed right in the middle.
It's good to seek balance,
Aunt Jo sometimes told me. Aunt Jo did yoga, so she would know. Our family belonged to a conservative temple balanced between Orthodox and Reform. Grandma Rita, my father's mother, didn't see it that way.
Lazy, hazy, crazy,
she said, summing up the three branches of Judaism and removing herself from all of them. Her father-in-law was a rabbi. That was more than enough to put up with.
Orthodox Jews? Crazy, in those black coats and long beards. 9 children, 9!
The Reform temple. My father shook his head dismissively. Short, lazy services, all that English. Might as well be in church. As a conservative Jew, I did feel quite hazy. We were neither good nor bad. Maybe good and bad. Our family drove on Saturdays and ate bacon and shrimp and cheeseburgers. I did go to Hebrew school 3 times a week. I was learning Hebrew. I had kept the Hanukkah candles company. And my yellow one was still burning. Did you know you aren't supposed to blow out Hanukkah candles? Even ones that are barely burning? Of course, you aren't supposed to leave a burning candle alone either, even though it was hard to imagine this nearly gone candle setting fire to anything. It might last another minute, maybe more, and the right thing to do was to sit with it until its flame was gone. But if I left the kitchen now, I could watch the end of The Grinch and see the Whos circle their bare tree, welcoming Christmas with their sweet, weird song. That was my favorite part. A Maccabee would resist such temptation. A citizen of the world would join in. I leaned close to the menorah. What did the candle have to say?
Erev Christmas by Ellen Orleans. We'll end this year's Hanukkah Lights special with a piece by R.L. Mazes. Her short stories have been published in numerous literary magazines, and her essays have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Spirituality and Health, and other national publications. She's currently working on a collection that includes this story, The Infidelity of Judah Maccabee.
At 42, Barry Waxman no longer had to wonder why everyone he knew had gotten theirs while he was still waiting for his. His life was full. At the Great Northeastern Insurance Company, he managed a dozen actuaries in white button-down shirts. He lived with Annette, a thin woman with a Nordic nose and long fingers that were always moving, bettering his life, filleting fish, unclogging drains, debugging his computer. His cat, Mac, was short-haired and gray. Vertical pupils cut his yellow eyes, black slits that emptied into an endless universe. If he wasn't massaging Barry's thighs with his thick paws, he was nipping the fleshy edge of Barry's palm or sandpapering it with his tongue. Barry was content until, looking out the window of his Brooklyn apartment one night, he saw lights strung around street lamps and a man wearing an elf hat. While he was at work the next day, Annette had a spruce tree delivered. In the 3 years they'd lived together, she had never done that before. She bolted the tree to a metal base, strung popcorn and tinsel, presenting him when he came home with a fait accompli, a 6-foot-tall Christmas tree that had dwarfed the electric menorah he had rested on the windowsill. Christmas confirmed Barry's fear that as a Jew, he would always be an outsider in America. Growing up, he had watched with envy while his schoolmates scribbled lists of presents, their anticipation growing as the holiday approached. But when Barry mentioned Christmas, his father exploded.
An excuse for pogroms!
Then he told Barry for the 100th time about Cossacks who had bloodied his grandfather in Ukraine and cut off his beard. One after another, the homes on Barry's block lit up, while his remained stubbornly dark, except for a small flickering menorah, proof to his neighbors, Barry worried, that his family didn't belong. As an adult, Barry resented that Christmas overshadowed Hanukkah. Menorahs and dreidels appeared as mere afterthoughts in shops, on single shelves, or in dim corners, while Christmas hijacked entire establishments and his favorite 80s rock and roll station, making it impossible for him to buy a pair of socks without considering the miracle of the birth of Jesus. The holiday intruded at Barry's job, too, where he was expected to play Secret Santa to a woman in human resources who consistently got his 401k contributions wrong. Perhaps, he thought, he should get her a calculator. Annette hovered to one side of the tree.
Do you like it?
There was a tremor in her voice. He had expressed to her his reservations about the holiday.
I thought it would balance things out.
He pressed his index finger to a ripe needle, relishing the sharp pain. We've never had a tree, he said, as if his objection were based on the details of their short life together rather than the annals of his people.
I always had one.
Mac sniffed the metal base of the tree, rubbed his back against it, and purred.
Mac likes it.
Barry snatched the cat and showed him the menorah. We're Jewish, Mac. Got it? But when he dropped Mac, the cat darted back to the tree. The tree's fragrance was out of place in his apartment, and Barry had the odd sensation he had wandered into someone else's home. How can I celebrate Christmas? Christians were responsible for the Crusades and the Inquisition. The church prevents people from using birth control and oppresses gays. Slim pieces of tinsel Annette ripped from the tree floated to the floor. Mac batted them back and forth between his paws and reared up on his hind legs before pouncing on them.
Is that how you think of me? As a gay oppressor?
Not you.
Other Christians.
Right.
Do you see how prejudiced that is? My parents were not responsible for the Crusades or the Inquisition, and homosexuals are welcome in their congregation.
Barry lifted Mac into his arms and sat at the dining room table, keeping the cat from the tree. Your parents served ham when we visited them because their German butcher assured them a rabbi blessed it.
You like ham.
They didn't know that.
You asked for seconds.
I was being polite. The cat wriggled until Barry released him. Picking gray fur off his black wool pants, Barry said, "You ambushed me." Annette sank into a chair next to him and stuffed a leftover roll of tinsel into a department store bag.
I knew if I asked you, you'd say no, but it hardly seems fair for my ornaments to gather dust in the closet while you light your menorah.
You never said anything.
I kept waiting for you to ask how I felt about not having a tree.
Barry approached the spruce and fingered the ornaments he could tell she had hung for him, the silver stars of David, the dreidels, and the latkes that resembled plastic barf people bought as gag gifts. He sighed. Where'd you find all these?
At the Jews for Jesus store in Cadman Plaza.
Curled at the base of the tree, Mac slept. The next night was the first night of Hanukkah. Barry left work early and stopped at Christidi's to pick up latkes and applesauce. Not as good as the ones his mother had made from a Manischewitz mix, the latkes nevertheless buttressed his soul against candy canes and fruitcakes. Next to the cash register, buried at the bottom of a stack of holiday CDs, below Bing Crosby's White Christmas and James Brown's Funky Christmas, he found a klezmer CD, and on impulse, he bought that too. Cat treats shaped like dreidels filled a bowl. He grabbed a handful for Mac. It was his 10th Hanukkah with Mac, a decade since he had come upon a young girl tending a litter of kittens in a torn cardboard box a few blocks from his apartment. The girl sat on a concrete stoop next to the box.
We can't keep them.
She shoved down the flaps to give Barry a better view.
Cats don't care if you give away their kittens.
Three black kittens tumbled over each other, and a tiny gray shivered in a corner, head pressed to the cardboard. Barry was returning from the supermarket, a heavy bag of groceries digging into each hand. Mustard-colored high-rises loomed over the Brooklyn street. Through the window of every apartment, Barry thought he saw a Christmas tree sparkling red and green. A giant wreath clung to every door. He dreaded returning to his empty apartment, to his simple electric menorah, no one to give him a gift and no one to receive one from him. The kittens chirped like baby birds.
Maybe you want two,
the girl said, shoulder-length brown hair slipping from the ponytail someone had half-heartedly banded. Her pea coat, unbuttoned, flapped in wind that bustled down the high-rise canyon. Consolidating his shopping bags in one hand, Barry scooped the gray kitten in his palm. Light and delicate as an egg, its fragility moved him. He cocooned it in the pocket of his black wool overcoat.
I think he's hungry,
the girl said, stamping her feet to warm them. Her worn jeans fell short of her ankles. He rummaged through his bags and found a box of butter cookies. As he stood it next to her, her mouth fell open, and he noticed how thin she was, moon shadows falling on the inward curve of her cheeks. While she tore open the box of cookies, he set his other bags next to her and continued home. Back at his apartment with the kitten, he switched on the menorah. He sang holiday songs from his childhood, "O Hanukkah" and "I Have a Little Dreidel," and danced with the animal pressed to his chest. They shared a dust-covered can of sardines. The oily fish had never tasted so good. He named the cat Judah Maccabee, after the warrior priest who led the Jews to victory over the Hellenists, and called him Mac for short. Why had he not always had a cat? His father had thought animals were dirty, to be kept outside, if at all. But Barry found in Mac a companion superior in many respects to his human associates. Irritations and slights, the disappearance of insurance science history and practice from his office, not being invited when other actuaries went to lunch, faded when he stroked Mac's velvet coat. He forgot that his best friend Gregory had stopped returning his calls after taking up with a pale, plump woman named Basha. The cat required little in the way of entertainment. A string of dental floss drawn across the couch could occupy him for hours. He batted a plush mouse across the floor and talked. How he talked! A machine-like purr, a high cry of hunger, a sharp protest when Barry accidentally stepped on him. As Barry rode the subway home from Gristiti's to Annette and Mac, he pictured his electric menorah glowing in the third-story window. Maybe next year he would light an oil menorah. He had always been afraid of the mess, and he knew the actuarial risk of lighting any kind of fire at home. The whole place could burn down if you weren't careful. The Gristiti's bag jounced on his lap with the motion of the train, releasing the smell of fried potato pancakes into the subway car, forecasting an evening during which his small family would celebrate Hanukkah. In the hall outside his apartment, he reached for his key and heard, "I saw Mommy kissing Santa Claus." He imagined it playing in a neighbor's apartment, perhaps Cindy Johnson, who clomped about in wedge heels, a silver cross nestled in her cleavage. Not that he looked. Barry had tried to forget the tree, but when he opened the door, there it was, crowding his dining room. As it turned out, the music was coming from the radio in his kitchen. Annette sang along as she slid a tray of pastel-colored Christmas cookies into the oven. She had placed the mixing bowl on the floor, and Mac was licking the pink batter. On a rack, a second tray of cookies cooled. Her holiday was taking over every room in the house. "Do you have to do that now? It's the first night of Hanukkah," he shouted over the chorus.
"I'll just set the timer on these, and we'll turn on the menorah."
She removed her apron, which had reindeer flying across the skirt. He snapped off the radio, but it was too late. His evening was spoiled. Why couldn't his home be Jewish for one night? His future would consist of baked hams and presents wrapped in mistletoe paper. Next, she would want to celebrate Easter. The kitchen smelled like someone else's childhood. Barry's mouth watered, and he wondered if that was how assimilation began, with baked goods. He worried he was betraying the memories of his father and grandfather. When he offered Mac a dreidel treat, the cat sniffed it and went back to the bowl of batter. 4:30 the next morning, Mac failed to bat Barry on the nose. Barry had always complained about Mac waking him so early to be fed, but it was a loving complaint. He would set a plate of kibble in the corner of the bedroom and close his eyes, the sound of the cat crunching like a white noise machine lulling him back to sleep. When he awoke to his alarm at 6, his first thought was something terrible had happened to Mac. He towed the gray lump asleep at his feet and elicited a bitter cry that reassured him. Perhaps, he reasoned, Mac had simply not been hungry. Out of curiosity, he checked Mac's bowl and found it had been filled with kibble in the night, half of which had been consumed. "Honey," he said, shaking Annette, "honey, did you feed Mac?" She was snoring, sucking long strands of delicate blonde hair into her mouth and then exhaling them. He shook her again.
"Barry, I'm sleeping,"
she groaned. "Did you feed Mac?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Because he was hungry."
"How did you know?"
"He tapped my nose."
At work, he phoned his older sister, Gladys, who had 4 children and a way of analyzing his problems that soothed him. When she talked, he could almost hear his mother explaining why he was better off when neighborhood boys excluded him from flipping baseball cards and games of pickup basketball.
"They probably have lice, or worse, worms."
He missed her.
"It's nothing,"
Gladys said.
"The cat didn't want to bother you. He knows you need your sleep to be sharp for work."
"He likes her because she's blonde and her fingers always smell like fish," Barry said. He was looking up Annette's life expectancy.
"Whose side of the bed does he sleep on?"
"Mine."
"Then you have nothing to worry about."
He made a note to give Gladys a discount when she renewed her policies. Gray light filtering into his bedroom woke Barry the next morning. The cat had already eaten. He wanted to instruct Annette not to feed Mac, to remind her Mac was his cat, but he despised his own insecurity. Mac's infidelity enraged him, but of course, there was no talking to the cat. He remembered how peaceful their lives had been before Annette. He would stretch out on the couch with a James Patterson thriller, Mac swatting the pages as he turned them. They would eat dinner together, Mac out of his bowl, and Barry straight from a Swanson's microwavable package. There had been no alien holidays to endure. After dinner that night, the cat climbed into Annette's lap rather than his, purring as loud as a jackhammer when Annette massaged his neck. It was the third night of Hanukkah, and Barry turned on the menorah. The lights jerked and twitched. Mac kneaded her thigh, nipped her hand, and rolled onto his side, inviting Annette to scratch his belly, something he had never allowed Barry to do. They pleasured each other right in front of him without shame. Barry fled to the bedroom. When his jealousy subsided, he remembered he owed his relationship with Annette to Mac. Gladys had sent him a link to an online dating site, but Barry hesitated to click on it. Women, he believed, were not attracted to pale actuaries. Tan investment bankers, yes. Ruddy lawyers, certainly. But not men like him. From Barry's lap, Mac pawed the computer, bringing up the profile of a blue-eyed accountant, a CPA no less, staring impatiently back at Barry. Like him, Annette had never been married and had spent her life devoted to numbers. Her skin was translucent. A soulmate? As quickly as he could, he composed a profile and showed it to Mac before posting it. On their first date, they chatted about standard deviations and probability distributions. They ate dim sum and joked about the odds of both having scientific calculator keychains. When she laughed, she revealed horsey gap teeth, and he immediately wanted to knock his own teeth against them. On their third date, he made love to her in his apartment under freshly laundered sheets and a quilt embedded with cat fur. He probed her teeth with his tongue and walked his hands over her knobby frame, learning the motions that pleased her. When he attended the symphony with Annette, Barry heard a richness in the sound that was new. Watching a romantic comedy with her, he imagined himself the leading man and Annette the leading woman, her smile as bright as Jennifer Aniston's. She would pat him lightly on the hand before pointing out something in the Sunday paper, her touch making him feel at long last that he was fully participating in life. At first, Annette and Mac ignored each other. Mac avoided her feet and turned away from dental floss she accidentally dropped. Barry had to correct Annette when she used the pronoun it to refer to Mac. But after she moved in and made fish stew, adding butter and onion and chunk after chunk of haddock, Mac warmed to her. Rubbing against her ankles, head-butting her belly when he found her in bed, Annette began to refer to him fondly as Big Mac.
"Everything all right, Barry?"
his boss asked the next day when he was late, turning in an end-of-year report. The woman was his age, pearls dotting her large earlobes, lines on her brow that darkened when she was annoyed. "Formatting it right now," he said evenly. Brooding over the holidays and cats, he had been distracted from his work. His blood pressure rising, he wondered, "Why is the firm closed on Christmas but open on Hanukkah? I ought to sue."
"Can I help?"
his secretary whispered after his boss was gone. "You can stay at your desk until I call you," he barked, though in the past they had always gotten along. A woman in black orthopedic shoes, clutching a maple cane, lurched onto the subway while he was riding home, but he pretended not to see. He had risen for her before, but now he reasoned her ride was short and he was not so young himself. At home, as Barry put away his briefcase and took off his suit jacket, Mac followed him through the apartment, crying. He picked the cat up roughly. "This morning you wanted her, but now you'll settle for me?" He harnessed the cat for a walk.
"Don't you want me to come?"
Annette asked. Wrapping a scarf around his neck, he avoided her eyes. "Maybe better if you didn't." Mac pulled him through a park, under naked ash trees, the ground alongside the concrete path frozen. Yellow bulbs flickered behind filmy lampposts. The cat sniffed a chihuahua in a pink sweater and licked the ears of a long-haired dachshund. He rubbed against a woman's stocking-clad legs, and she bent to pet him. Barry had once delighted in strangers' enjoyment of Mac, but now he imagined them stealing the cat's affection, and he headed home. Annette had switched on the menorah. It was the fourth night of Hanukkah, and put on the klezmer CD. To his surprise, Barry discovered he didn't like klezmer, but grateful for the effort Annette was making, he threw up his hands and pretended to conduct the band. For dinner, Annette served warm, creamy blintzes with sour cream and applesauce. Barry sat back and admired the golden crepes. "Like the kind my mother used to buy," he said. He filled Annette's glass with seltzer and refilled it again when it was only half empty. After they ate, Annette pulled Barry to her and they danced around the dining room, spinning away from the Christmas tree and back, the sounds of the fiddle and flute uplifting them. For once, his angular limbs moved gracefully, and though he was leading, he knew she was subtly guiding him. When they tired, they sat on the floor, and Barry taught Annette how to spin the dreidel and the meaning of the Hebrew letters painted on its side.
Now I'm an honorary Jew.
She'd be back to her tree tomorrow, Barry thought, but there was no harm in pretending for a night. Annette stripped foil from a chocolate coin, fed it to Barry, and licked her fingers.
Forget Christmas. Everyone loves cookies,
Annette said in the morning as she prepared a plate for Barry to take to work. Feeling like a traitor to his people, he set her homemade cookies, stars and trees painted with icing and dotted with sprinkles, in the break room, a note from Barry and Annette alongside. Colleagues who had ignored him in the past stopped by his office. They asked about his holiday plans and shared company gossip. One pounded him on the back while wishing him Merry Christmas. Barry enjoyed the attention, blushing during the boisterous visit, but he resented it took Christmas to bring it about. Christmas Eve fell on the seventh night of Hanukkah. Barry lit the menorah, and Annette tuned the radio to a station playing carols. She poured eggnog and champagne, made roast duck with latkes on the side, the savory smells filling the apartment, torturing Mac, who paced in front of the oven while the duck cooked. Barry wondered why his holiday rated only a side dish. Annette's family had always opened gifts on Christmas Eve. Barry gave her an antique slide rule for Hanukkah, and for Christmas, tickets to the New York Philharmonic performing Handel's Messiah. For Mac, he bought a New York Mets collar and a pot of catnip. Annette plucked Barry's present from under the tree and handed it to him. Tearing away the tissue paper, he uncovered a photo of Annette and Mac in a heart-shaped frame, the cat curled in her lap, eyes half closed.
All your loves,
Annette cooed, admiring the photo over his shoulder. Barry stared at the picture. It's like I don't even exist.
It's to show how much we love you, me and Mac.
Who took the picture?
We went to his studio.
You took a family photo without me. Barry dropped the photo to the floor, breaking the glass.
Barry!
She reached for his hand, but he yanked it away. Mac hid under the couch. Grabbing his coat, Barry left the apartment. Outside, he trudged down frigid, empty streets. Through brightly lit windows, he saw rooms full of people celebrating. Reviewing his relationship with Annette, Barry found slights everywhere. She rarely wanted to go out to eat, claiming she preferred to cook. But now Barry suspected she was ashamed to be seen with him in public because of his dark, curly hair and prominent nose. When she introduced him to her parents, she said he was from Brooklyn and his ancestors had emigrated from Eastern Europe. Barry had to add he was Jewish. Was she ever planning to tell them? They were from Scandinavia, the mother 6 inches taller than Barry. Why had he ever thought it could work? Hunger eventually drove him home. Annette had swept up the glass. No evidence of the photo remained. They sat at the dining room table, silently eating a cold meal. Christmas Day, Barry studied loss models at the kitchen table, while in the living room, Annette caught up on new IRS regulations. Mac padded between the two, gnawing Annette's shoelaces, swatting the cuffs of Barry's pants. When Annette came into the kitchen to heat the kettle, Barry didn't look up. He ignored her offer of a cup of tea. Darkness swept through the apartment. Though it was the last night of Hanukkah, Barry didn't bother to light the menorah. Annette hadn't cooked. They ate reheated leftovers while watching the evening news.
Why don't we take Mac for a walk?
Annette said after dinner. What else have we got to do? Barry said, rinsing plates and stacking them in the dishwasher. Barry harnessed the cat, and they walked along the sidewalk, talking only of mundane things, when they had to be back at work and their need to buy coffee and eggs. As they passed the apartment building where Barry had found Mac so many years before, he glanced through a window into a lobby with a giant Christmas tree and paused when he saw a girl in her late teens gathering with her family to go out for the holiday. The girl's down coat hung open over a thick wool sweater and pressed pants. Her hair, neatly brushed, shone.
Do you know her?
She could be the girl who gave me Mac. She's about the right age. But it was a long time ago. Barry remembered how fragile Mac had seemed, how worried he had been the kitten would suffocate in his pocket, the only place he knew to keep it warm, how relieved he had been to get home and find it still alive. Annette smiled, her teeth enormous in the street lamp glow.
Our Mac.
She linked her arm with Barry's, and he, reluctantly, left it there. Mac jerked the leash forward, leading Barry beyond landmarks he knew into neighborhoods he had never visited, to a downtown where the lettering on signs was exotic, the cat moving faster, always, than Barry wanted to go.
That was The Infidelity of Judah Maccabee by R.L. Mazes, the final piece in our program. You've been listening to Hanukkah Lights, Stories of the Season. To hear these stories again, along with earlier Hanukkah Lights programs, please visit our website, npr.org.
Hanukkah Lights was produced by Soraya Mohammed. The Vice President for Programming and Audience Development is Anya Grundman.
I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Murray Horwitz.
Happy Hanukkah, everyone! Everybody.